Okay, showtime. Okay, welcome
everybody. What did you do last week?
Huh?
Did you turn on the recorders?
Yeah.
Well, what did you do last week? If I wasn't here, when I wasn't here.
I don't remember. I asked.
How do you know when to start?
I asked. I asked your better half. Anyway, okay, welcome everybody. Tonight is December 30th. And this is the seventh lecture in the French Revolution. So tonight, I wanted to talk about the Batavian Republic, which is like Belgium, the Netherlands, Holland, Amsterdam, which is a place which is north of France. So the Jewish history there is rather interesting. But the one reason I want to get to, and I hope we can get to it at the end, is really because of the involvement of France and the takeover of France in the Batavian Republic. They actually ended the Batavian Republic, and they started before the French came in with the Batavian Republic. There was more freedom with the Jews that happened, and as a result of that, there was a breakaway minion that did different things, which was, I don't know if it was the inspiration for the Reform Movement, but the Reform Movement copied a lot of the changes that shul did. So I just wanted, let's get to what happened in the Netherlands with the French Revolution, and then we'll see how this affected the Jews there, and eventually it's going to have an influence on Reform Jewry in general. Okay, so I just turned everything off. Okay, so this is where this is really the Netherlands. It's the this is the Batavian Republic, or whatever that's in Flemish, I guess. And it's really north of France, okay? This is the area, basically, around here is Amsterdam. That's where the main things happen in this area. Okay, the Jews started coming. The Jews, they have some records of Jews even from the Roman times. Mm. But things really didn't get going there until the Sephardim started coming. The Sephardim, so in 1492, Sephardim were kicked out. They were told in 1492 that they either have to leave Spain, or they can convert to Christianity, or they must leave Spain. And it really affected about 200,000 Jews. Most, the rest of the Jews stayed. So probably just as many, if not more, stayed in Spain. Many of the Jews, if not about half the Jews, went to Portugal. The other went all over Europe. Many of them coming to Amsterdam. 4 years later, they thought everything was good to go to Portugal, which is bordering on the west of Spain. But 4 years later, Portugal made the same decree, and they said, "Yeah, you have to become Christian, or you have to leave." So the Jews were ready to leave because these were the Jews. They left once, they're going to leave again. These were the Jews, and not interested in becoming Christians. And King Manuel, we spent a whole year on this, either double crossed them or tricked them and forcibly converted them. And it wasn't really a conversion, but forcibly converted them and said, "Now that you're all Christians, that's it, you don't have to leave anymore." And basically locked them in and then just said, I'm not going to bother you. Yeah, you've been through such a trauma for 20 years. But that's, and eventually that's where the Jewish community that was really Jews and did not want to be Christian, that's where, when we speak about Anusim or Maranos, many of the stories, or most of the stories, really come from Portugal. In any case, many of the Jews did get out, and many of the Jews found haven in this area, in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, Dutch, Holland. It was much, much more liberal. They were open, and the Jews that came there, for the most part, were able to practice Judaism. Or even if they had to be a nusim, they were able to, they had more freedom in that respect. So many of them came in 1492, and again 1496 and 1497 from Spain and Portugal respectively. Okay, they came in, and it's like an amazing thing. The Jews come in, and now all of a sudden Dutch becomes like a world trading partner. I mean, as the trade starts picking up, this small little country of nothing is now that Jews come in and they start trading overseas and start, you know, with competition with Spain and Portugal, two of the greatest powers, maritime powers of the time. And the Dutch, with the help of the Jews, these Jews help find their way, help make something out of the Dutch. Okay, they arrived. These were the Sephardim, and they arrived. These were wealthy Sephardim, very acculturated. Spain, even as Jews, they were part of the society, very acculturated. They didn't live in their own ghettos like they did in Eastern Europe. So they fit into the society. They came wealthy. They came with their money, and they were strong supporters of the House of Orange. The House of Orange were their protectorate. And they were very, very loyal to the government.
The date on this slide says 1593. That's
yes.
Like a whole 100 years.
I'm not sure. It could be a mistake. But these are a nusim. Again, it could be over the years they were coming in. So, I guess they could have been coming in waves. Because they were all trying to get out. Some were successful. Some were not. And event, many, many a nusim tried to get out, and there was a Spanish Portuguese shul, I'm not sure if I have it here, that actually started, and the language they spoke was Portuguese because of all the Portuguese Jews that had eventually escaped. But they did come out in waves as they were able to. Okay, there was some 12-year truce in the early 1600s. And the Dutch Republic increased their trade, and they had foreign trade in all of the Mediterranean, Venice, the Levant, Morocco. The Sultan of Morocco made some deal with them, and they started dealing in the Barbary States, which is North Africa. Then in 1621, the West Indies Company, Jews were on the board, and now they had... West Indies was in the New World, in America, and they were, doing business in there. They actually, Dutch for a time, owned Brazil. And they again, it's not, a little bit, we spoke about this, but they actually, eventually they're going to lose Brazil to Portugal. But at one point, they were the dominating foreign power in Brazil. In 1642, they needed more craftsmen. So 600 Jews left Amsterdam for Brazil. And about 10, 12 years later, when Portugal took it over, they had to leave. Because Portugal, you couldn't be, they had the Inquisition, and you couldn't be a Jew, and you couldn't be a practicing Jew in their territory. So they did leave. I think from there, they may have gone up into America, and maybe in Rhode Island, in Newport. The shul, many of these people were different areas. The Toro Synagogue, these were from the same group. And they made their way there. Okay. They were able to become doctors, but they were not able to become lawyers. And one of the reasons is because it was a lawyer, you had to make some sort of you had to swear, shrua, and the shrua they expected you was on the Christian Bible. And the Jews wouldn't do that. Well, you can't make the oath, and you can't be a lawyer. They were very into printing, book selling, meat, poultry, groceries, medicine. They had one of the most liberal bookbinding places. So any Jew from Eastern Europe that wanted to get his book published, many, there were only like two or three places you can go to. The Christians, we spent time on this also in the past, the Christians, they knew this is, this, we have to control this. If we
right.
don't control this, we're in trouble, and they control, they did. And there were only like a few places. It was a place in Italy, Cicino, right? The Cicino Press
right.
in Italy, and Amsterdam, that was one of the big places. Amsterdam was a very popular place for Jews in Eastern Europe to travel to get their books published. And this is what the Sparta community was doing there. Two very famous Spartan that we are familiar with is Menashe ben Yisrael, and he was the Rav. He was the one that Great Britain, England, had kicked out their Jews, and we spoke about this as well. And Menashe ben Yisrael he came to the British Parliament to allow the Jews to get back in. Now, he really thought he was unsuccessful, but really largely due to his efforts, the Jews were allowed in. I think at that time it was Oliver, if I'm not mistaken, it was Oliver Cromwell. It was during the revolution period. Had Oliver Cromwell said yes, see how Hashem runs the world, then a few years later when he lost power and the king took over, the king would have said no, because Oliver said yes. So Oliver didn't say yes, so the king didn't say no. Right? Something along those lines. And the other one is Baruch Spinoza. He was put to Cheirim. He was a philosopher, and he became a very famous philosopher, and it was unfortunately, he was way off, but he was very influential, and the religious community as well as the non-religious community had to deal with the fact that he was put into Cheirim and his ideas and why his ideas were off. But again, that's not for now. Now you get to the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim, where did they come into this area? And we're really more going to focus in on the Ashkenazim, because that's where this is going to, where our story is going to take place. But they came from Germany. Jews in Germany never had a good day. I mean, it was just, you know, you were there for a while, and then any count or leader there could just expel the Jews. More often than that, they just expelled them as opposed to just kill them, but it was never, you know, it was always touch and go in Germany for hundreds of years, and that's how they lived. The Chacham Tzvi was the big Rav of the time. He was also the father of what's his name? Reb Yaakov Emden, I believe that was Reb Yaakov Emden's father, and Yaakov Emden did not become the rabbi after his father. Reb Yonatan Eibeshitz did. That's another thing which we covered. They got from Jews trying to escape oppression in ghettos. It was also the 30 Years' War, which is a Protestant and Catholic war that went through Europe. And many people were displaced. Jews found themselves in Amsterdam as well. And lastly, from the Chmielnytskyi's uprising. And this was, we covered this, we spent a good year on this, or just about, much of a year, of the Jews in the Ukraine. And those that were, when they were expelled, some made it as far as Amsterdam. Amsterdam is relatively west, but you know, if you went from Ukraine and you didn't, Poland, the whole Poland was in turmoil, so you would just keep going into Germany, and more west of Germany would be Amsterdam. So the Jews were in big turmoil then, and that's also waves of Jews would have been coming to Amsterdam as well. Now up to 1648, we're only about 150 years till our period. These Ashkenazim that came were poor. It was like, you know, it wasn't like they felt that they could add to the Amsterdam community. They weren't as welcome as much as their Sephardic counterparts. And if they were able to stay in Holland or the Netherlands, they were smaller communities all around, not necessarily in Amsterdam. Okay. Okay, what were they in? They're retailing, trading, diamond cutting. Diamond cutters, even today, Belgium, you know, is still into diamonds today. They had the monopoly on cutting diamonds even until the late 1800s. Okay, William the Fourth was the stadtholder, I guess the leader of the area in 1747. And he was a protectorate of the Jews. The Jews were loyal to him, and he was, you know, for a leader in Europe, relatively good to the Jews. And the Jews, he was, I guess his house was called the House of Orange, and he was very good to the Jews. Again, the Jews were very supportive of the House of Orange. However, the Jews were, it wasn't like today here in America where the Jews could do just about anything. Whatever prejudices and biases and whatever they did to the Jews all over Europe, they did there as well. But at least they weren't being killed, persecuted, chased out, money stolen, except relatively they had it secure. He had a good relationship with many Jews, William the Fourth. It says in 1748 there was a French army that was attacking. The problem is there was no money in the coffers to fight off the French army. This is 1748, this is before, it's about 50 years still before Napoleon or anything. And there was a Yid by the name of De Pinta that collected a large sum and gave it to the state. They were able to pay the army to fight off the French. And he was credited with, you know, wow, you saved the state, you saved. And, I don't understand what he did there. Something else with the economy. Now came his son, William V. And again, by William V already, the country was more in turmoil. And they were more like liberal ideas were coming about, but the Jews were loyal to him. Again, the House of Orange, they were loyal to him. They actually gave a special service or a Thanksgiving service when he actually took his seat in 1766. He visited the German and Portuguese synagogues, the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim in 1768. I guess that was for a leader to do that was significant. It wasn't done all the time. He also attended marriages. Okay, that was the fifth. And then came, the Batavian Revolution. So in 1780 to 1787, there was unrest in this area. There were patriots. I'm not exactly sure what all the issues were. But like that was a time in Europe where unrest and there was more liberal ideas and more fraternity, and this was as well was happening in France, was happening all over and happened here as well. To such a point that in 1785, William V felt he had to flee the country, and he was married to the sister of Frederick William II. I think that's the way it was, unless they were brother-in-laws the other way. And he asked Frederick, to maybe he could send me an army to help me get back in power, which he did. And he sent the Prussian army, which put William V back in power in 1787. Okay, so now 1787, the House of Orange is back in, and the patriots are like below the surface. They're out. They're around, but they're out. If you remember, we said 1789 is when the French Revolution starts. That's when France ran out of money, and the King Louis the 16th was it or 14th? I don't remember. He got all the houses together, and that's when everything went crazy. Okay, so that was 2 years before that. Okay, in 1794-95, again, we're in the middle of the French Revolution. Napoleon is not going to take over until 1799, 1800. So this is smack in the middle of the French Revolution. The French once again send a force. I guess somehow it was some river that froze over, and the French with some Dutch came, and basically they kicked out the House of Orange, and they turned it over into a republic called the Batavian Republic.
Mm.
Now, the Batavian Republic was also very liberal, very into this brotherhood ideas, everybody's equal, and the one thing they're going to be much, much more favorable to the Jews than the stadtholder. I don't know if he was a king or like a king, but they're going to be much more favorable. Now, the Jews overall, they are favoring the House of Orange, and yet the revolutionaries are going to give the Jews more freedom. So, like, what do you do? They're like an interesting situation, you know. So, So the Batavian Republic starts in 1795, and this is going to be significant for us because something's going to our shoe that we're going to be talking about, the Adas Yeshurun, is going to be able to be opened in 1795 with the Batavian Republic. So we're just going through the history of what's happening outside, and the Jews there are all involved. This is, you have a government under a House of Orange, and now the revolutionists are involved. It's going to end, at some point, France is going to annex it, and the king is going to put his brother, Jerome, as king. So eventually they're going to go from a revolution to a monarch, which is the king, which is a brother of Napoleon, which is exactly what happened in France. They went from a revolution to a monarch, to an emperor. Now in 1795 they had a national convention, and in 1790 when they made their convention, they said no Jews shall be excluded. They were very cutting edge to include the Jews in everything. So the Jews really had like full freedom to do just about anything here. Rights and advantages with citizenship. There was a Jew that was appointed as member of the municipality in Amsterdam, also just, and a member of the Court of Justice, another Jew. It was just like, wow, this is, they're really, really helping out. Again, this is where the Batavian Republic was, and notice just north of France, and this is, I think, Germany over here. So this is the area, I'm not sure what the difference between orange and light gray is, I'm not sure what, but these were different areas in the Republic. Okay. The Jews themselves did not want these emancipation rights. The Jews, they were from. I mean, all Jews were religious Jews and all over the place, and these freedoms were not necessarily needed for them. They were really more wanted they felt very loyal to the house that was the Oranges, and they were given freedom, something that they weren't necessarily needed or wanted. They realized maybe also the leaders of the Jewish community were going to lose a lot of their control with the more open democratic society. What's going to happen there is going to happen to them as well. Okay. In 1798 they actually made a constitution which totally included the Jewish people. And in 1801, there's going to be a few rebellions, coup d'etats. There's always unrest from one revolution to the other. I just want to get to, okay. Well, another thing is in the Batavian Republic, the Reformed Church that was there was like they had the monopoly on the church and the government. They lost that, and that's where it went to the Jews. and Christians and Lutherans and Protestants, all these different, everything was open now. This is it, freedom, total freedom. And they didn't, they took away, you know, not one religion. It's not your, you got it, nobody else. This
the,
is
the
it.
The Reformed Church, that was Protestant?
Yes, definitely.
So what you're saying is they lost some government support.
Right.
They, I mean, essentially it comes down to they no longer recognize them as the state sanctuary.
Correct. But, that,
them, but they said, they're all okay, but
right.
I'm paying for anything.
Right.
You could all, I think that's what they're doing.
Right. It's going to change when, you know, the Jerome,
right.
when Napoleon gets back in charge. Okay, no, again, I think I did this one already. This is what, but you should just know at the time, there were 50,000 Jews, 47,000 of them were Ashkenazim.
Wow.
Okay, and so the here, the Ashkenazim were a major, major majority of the Batavian, or the Holland, Amsterdam. Half of these Jews lived in Amsterdam. Probably most of the Spartan Jews lived there. There's only 3,000. And about half, so they had about 25,000 Jews that were in Amsterdam. The other 25,000 were in areas all around. Okay, so now, again, they, just what they you see, in 1798, they interceded with the foreign affairs of Jews in Germany. So like to such a point where they feel, we're gonna make a statement for other Jews, you know, like a government making a protest about some other government and on behalf of Jews, again, is very like unique, unheard of. That they did. Okay, now in 1799,
well,
again, in order to help the Jews, they did get some sort of grants
so
from the trend, right? But right, they really believed. It looks like the people who were doing these revolutions really believed in the cause. And if you believe at all, you know, you're coming from instead of coming from. Kings and like royalty and nobles and first estates and the peasants and people are second civic great citizens. So here too you have this. That's what we have. They want everybody's equal. You know, you're no special. You don't have this divine right that you have from God. They disagreed with it. And therefore they're trying to make everybody equal and. They believe in it, and look what we're doing. We're actually helping them out. In 1806, so now they were, I guess, Napoleon, as he made his own kingdom, own France, much stronger, and at this point already he was elected emperor for life. So now he annexed Holland. Actually, he annexed the entire Europe, but he had different relationships with different countries. Some of them were just allies, but this, the Batavian Republic, he totally annexed it, removed it. So in 1806, there was no more Batavian Republic. It now was a monarch under his brother, and under his brother Louis. This is Louis. Jerome is going to be in Germany. So Louis Bonaparte, and he was now the king. So that's going to change things in terms of the way the Jews were for those 10 years. And now, eventually, Louis is going to also, he's going to want to help the Jewish cause and make things better. But one of the things he changed was just like in France, the Jews were under this consistory, right? The government was in charge of all the religions, the Christian religions, the Jewish religions. You had to answer to them. This same thing was now put in place in Amsterdam. So up until that time, the Jews had total freedom. Now you have to answer to the government. Okay, so now that's going to change, which in certain respects is going to be better for the Jewish community, but it's also going to be worse. And, okay, so one of the few things that he did as a king, first of all, just like to help the Jews, he changed the market day in some cities from Shabbos to Monday, so the Jews could participate. He abolished this this oath that you had to take, a special Jews, Jewish oath that they had to take because they were trusted, he removed that as well. And not only that, but he actually made a army of Jews. So he formed two battalions, 803 men, and 60 officers. All of them were Jews. So he had a special Jewish army in the entire army of Belgium. Okay, he wanted to. He wasn't able to. He only was there for 3-4 years. He wanted to make he wanted to start schools for Jewish children. I don't think he meant yeshivas, but at least you know whatever. They were being excluded during, in the society around them, he wanted to help them with that as well. Okay. In 1813, this is already when Napoleon was lost and everything went back to the way it was. So William VI, he was crowned as King William I and it went back to the House of Orange. Okay, this is basically in 1814. They made a special thing. Now there's nothing, no more Bonaparte. We're back to the way it was. There were many Jews that fought at Waterloo against Napoleon. 35 Jewish officers died of the 60, I guess.
They fought against.
I take that back. I'm not. I don't even know. I don't even know. It would make sense.
Well, Allied armies.
Waterloo was already. He was. Waterloo was his final loss.
Right, yeah.
He lost once. They sent him to an island. He got out of the island. They went to arrest him again, and instead of arresting him, his French soldiers went ahead and backed him. And then the rest of Europe had enough is enough, and they sent everybody. And so, most likely, I'm guessing that they came in on the Allied side. They didn't come in. They didn't come in.
Yeah, because he says he's praying to the Allies up above. Then
right.
He says there were
right.
Jews fighting at Waterloo against.
Okay. So this is the basically the outside. This is what was really going on outside of. This is the just a very short sikkum of Holland, and during this time now. What happened is during this time in 1795, like we mentioned before, the revolution took over, the House of Orange was out, and now the Jews were basically free to do whatever they wanted. So what happened? So there were these 21 maskilim, young families. Maskilim means that they felt that they were more part of society. They didn't feel they felt more acculturated, more modern, and basically they wanted to make their own shul. Until this time, the Amsterdam community, 25,000 about, right, 20 some odd thousand, were controlled in overall by 7 parnassim. Seven probably of the richest Jews, and that's it. They were in charge of everything. Overall, the community was a very religious community. All Jews were religious. Either you were a firm Jew, you were nothing. You know, it was just there was no in between. There's nowhere to go. So now you started now in the 1700s, Jews that felt more acculturated. And the society was beginning to become more accepting of Jews, especially in Western Europe, Germany, France, and here in Holland. And they wanted their own rabbi. So they broke off of the shul, and they started their own shul. It was 21 families. And these 21 families they got themselves a rabbi Granblum. I don't know if I'm spelling it right, but Granblum was Isaac Granblum, Yitzchak Granblum. Now, he himself was a ger, and he himself was a rav in the community, and he came from Sweden, I think. He was out from outside, and what basically did is that he became the rabbi of these 21 maskilim families, Eventually, the families grew to 100 families. So now it was a little bit of a bigger shul. And he was in charge, and it was about for 10 years. He died in 1806. So now for 10 years, he had this shul, and the Parnassim could do absolutely nothing to stop it. Before that time, the Parnassim are, you know, I guess commissioned or whatever from the government, from that House of Orange, you're in charge of your community. And they would never allow such a shul to take place. Now, I'm sure there were many shuls, but this was a shul that made very specific changes. Okay. Okay, so we're going to just, this is just, we're going to make changes in 1806, Napoleon ended the Vegetarian Republic. When this happened, it ended the shul as well. You know, so, well, basically they were able to have a shul, and when Louis Napoleon took over, it was the end of the Vegetarian Republic, and basically now it went back under the king. He made a consistory, even though there were some people from the Grand Blum shul that were part of the consistory, but most of the consistory was from the main community, and basically the main community voted Adas Yishurim out of existence. So that's it. There was no more shul whatsoever. Okay, now we...
So that created a warm fuzzy feeling.
So we do know what happened at shul because Rabbi Granblum's son wrote a book. He wrote a sefer called Melitz Yosher. And this Melitz Yosher was a book that explained, he was trying to explain everything his father did. Okay, and we're going to see he did things which sort of would make sense, things that were like, whoa, how could he do that? But some of the things he did, we actually do today. Right, you'll see some of the things, I guess, we incorporated some of the, but all these changes here were just for the time, radical. So what was some of them? So first of all, the Amsterdam community had a minute of completing Tehillim every week. So I guess every day, you know, the Tehillim is broken up into different ways. You have, you say, this, how much you say for 7 days a week, you could finish, mm-hmm. You can finish in 30 days. So they used to do it, finish it every week, but that was very long. So Rav Granblum said, let's, instead of doing it in 7 days, we'll do the 30-day. You know, in this way, everybody will say less, but you'll say less with more kavanah. That was their thing. Oh, I do want to say just one other thing is, this community, these people, held themselves as Orthodox. They believed themselves that we are part of the Jewish community. They were religious Jews. They held themselves as religious Jews. Just that, you know, we feel more comfortable doing things differently. As opposed to when the Reform Movement came out, these were Jews that were very limited tie to the Jewish community. They didn't feel themselves religious or Orthodox, as we call ourselves. Number two. Slichos. Many of the Slichos in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur were deleted. But those that they did say, they did line by line. Now, we also don't, it's like today, how many slichos do we do? It depends on the school you go to. Now, one of the things was is that they were trying, why did they start to do this? What was the main
work?
What was the main reason why they were making changes in the shul? What was the motivation? So one of the motivation, and again, being part of the Maskilim, is that they felt themselves part of the general society, and this is going to be for the Reformers also. They felt themselves like a sister religion to the Christians. There's the Christian religion, there's the Jewish religion. And they took a look at the Christian churches, and the Christian churches, they had decorum, everybody's sitting nicely, nobody's talking. You know, and they felt that was the right way to have a service. That's on the one hand. The other hand as well is from the Spanish Portuguese synagogue. the Spartan, their shul also had a different type of a look to it. It had a different type of a feeling and a mode, and they wanted in certain respects to copy the Spanish as well. Okay, and one of the things like you see line by line, many of the things we're going to see that they we daven line by line, like the Spartan do today. I don't know if any of us daven's in a Spartan shul. You'll see that's how they do it line by line. I went to a Spartan camp and that's how they daven line by line. They say it out loud together. Number three was the mourners say Kaddish in unison. So I guess, you know, like today, you know, somebody gives a clap, or we do it this way. And, you know, mostly most of our shuls, the mourners try to say it in unison. In some shuls, even, you know, from shuls, they get tell all the mourners to stay in one spot, to stay in the middle, so they could also. But I guess, you know, for many years, one would start and the other would start, and you'd hear Amen, and everybody sang Amen, the Yeshua Rav different times. And they felt it was not decorum enough, so that's what they wanted. Number four, Chazan stands at the beam in the middle of the shul and not in the front. I mean, this, we don't do this, but the we do it for Kabbalah Shabbos. But Musaf, is it Musaf that we do it? No. Before Musaf.
Some
shul Musaf. But they, why did they do this? Again, because they wanted everybody to hear the chazan. You know, he was up in the front, so if he's not so loud, those in the front would hear, but the rest of the shul, so they put him in the middle so that everybody can hear. That was another difference that they made. Next, Birchas Kohanim. On Yontif, I don't know if they did it every day of the week or every Shabbos, or was it just on Yontif? The Sfardim, they do Berachas Kohanim every day. Okay, so that's it. When they it says Musaf here, so it's probably during Yontif, instead of doing it during Musaf, when it's more noisy, they would do it, they switch it to Shabbos. Also, the Psukim, if you look in Berachas Kohanim, all the Psukim, we don't say the Psukim. So this could have been because the Birchas Kohanim was stretched out and was so long, because you now have to sing for every word in order to give everybody a chance to say every pasuk, you know, for every word. So they felt maybe that was too time consuming. They're looking to save time, and they're also looking for more decorum. That's why they changed that as well. Also, no extra aliyahs, you know, on Shabbos. Right? So that's it. You know, you got a certain amount. You want the Shabbos service to move. Yeah, they did other things that took longer time, but this is one of the things they felt. You know, I guess the in-between aliyahs causes more talking and more less decorum and more time, and that's it. Only 6-7. So, you know, if anybody has a simcha, you're next to an aliyah, it's very hard not to have that option. Okay, next. They ended the custom on Simchas Torah. They felt if everybody has to get an aliyah, they added so much time, and it's, what's everybody else doing when you're getting aliyah? They would probably there was a lot of drinking going on or whatever. They felt, no, we're going to end that as well. Number eight was piyutim. I guess there were, we say very few piyutim, but I guess on different Shabbosim there were piyutim. I remember growing up in my young Israel, they would say like these yotzros or piyutim on the four Shabbos, right? Shabbos Chedesh, Shabbos Parshas Para, Parshas Zachar. So I remember those four where there was something said. They would hand out special papers, but we don't say these as well. I guess we somehow it got lost by us as well. You know, Krovitz is all these are different things in the shul that's not said. And that was like something that the community said, how do you have the nerve not to say certain things? Okay, now this next one is huge. Huge. They said no Chazaras Hashatz. There's nobody, the reason for Chazaras Hashatz, at least the original reason, is that people don't know Hebrew, so they don't know how to speak, so they wait for the Shteach Tzibur, and he says there's Chazaras Hashatz, and everybody's listening, and they're being yotzi with him. And everybody here knows Hebrew, and therefore Chazaras Hashas is not needed, no Chazaras Hashas. Now, There are other reasons why we say Chazaras HaShas, and some people, some farshim or explanations on the Chazaras HaShas is even more important than the singular. So that's what they said, no Chazaras HaShas. The only thing is...
Do we know if this was like a
Hefer Kedusha? Give me a second. So what happened? Also no Kittel on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. They felt the robing and disrobing again. Lack of decorum. Let's save some time. Now, this is where you'll see how they got Hefer Kedusha. Kabbalah Shabbos and Pizuk Yedizim were said together, word by word, until after the bracha of Tchias HaMeisim and Shmoneh Esrei. So in this respect, they follow the Sfardim. They like that idea that everybody, we're all saying it all together, we're saying the word. So what they did is, they started like Baruch Shema, whatever, and it was all said together, all the way straight through Berachas Shema, into Shmoneh Esrei. And basically what they did is, the first three, four Berachas of Shmoneh Esrei, they all stood up and they were all saying it together through Kedusha, and then silent, and that's it. They wouldn't do a repetition. Now, in terms of taking time, this, to me, I don't know, this seems to be that, you know, maybe they weren't so, you know, they saved their time by not saying other things. And they spent more time saying what they said out loud, slower. Okay? Only also Hallel. Only the Chazan can say Hallel. That was also another thing that they made up of. And Hagba, again, to copy the Sfardim, Hagba was done before Kriyas HaTorah. They picked up the Torah. That's what Sfardim do. They pick up the Torah, they do Zos HaTorah before Kriyas HaTorah. When they read, that's what the Shul did as well. Okay, next, no Avarachamim. Now, Avarachamim is for a different reason. Avarachamim is basically, we're saying Hashem, take revenge, wipe out our enemies. Right? Wipe out the Goyim, our enemies. And they were afraid, well, the Goyim are nice to us these days, and therefore we don't want to, it's not befitting to say it, because the Goyim are starting to come around to the Jews, and that's why they didn't want to say Avarachim. Okay? This is another new thing that was initiated. Now, up until this time, the rabbi basically only spoke twice a year. Rosh Hashanah, he spoke Shabbat Gadol and Shabbat Shuvah. That was it. And it was often a pilpul and a drasha. But, you know, people maybe, it sounds like even people could argue, they instituted the rabbi would give a drasha every Shabbos, and nobody could interrupt. And we do that now. I guess some of these ideas were pretty good ideas, but for the time, without consulting and doing it on their own, that was like, okay. Now this is something outside the shul. This is huge. And basically they permitted kitnias on Pesach. Now, again, I guess to be like the Sfardim, they said the original decree of kitnias is not nogeya anymore, and therefore we they were permitting that as well. So not too many things
outside of shul.
Right. Something that was not a change inside the shul, but for them outside the shul. In other words, they were now a community. It wasn't that they were just part of the shul and everything else. But once you're your own community, now you need everything. So you need, you know, you need your own shaykhet, which they had to supply. They needed their own cemetery, which is what they supplied. Also, another huge thing about a cemetery, which is in around that time in England, it started. They reinterred. They took out some people that were buried, and when they opened up, it was recently they had to reinter, take them out, and they noticed inside the coffin scratch marks. Which would mean that they were buried alive. And because of that, the government of England and many of these governments in Western Europe said you can't bury the dead for 48 hours. And it was a big, you know, the reform, this became a big thing for the reform. That was their That was their big thing for reform. But it's against halacha because we hold that it should be buried as quick as possible. This, oh, by the way, as a result of this, what they did is they used to, on a dead body in England, they used to tie a string to the big toe of the dead body.
Right.
They would put a hole through the coffin, and on top of the grave, they would put a bell. And if the dead body moved, it would ring the bell, which is gave, this is the saying of the midnight watch. That's, this is, and it gave, this is where the saying of saved by the bell came from. I always thought it was my students were just like, gotta get to recess, and they're ready to go, and they're saved by the bell, yes. You know, all right.
What about dead ringer?
Okay, yeah, I never heard that, but
yes.
Dead ringer, okay. Very good, yes. I did hear the, okay. Okay, so this is, so that, because they had their own cemetery, so they also waited 48 hours. They felt, okay, they also, it's very important to know the difference, they felt that they were within the scope of halacha. They weren't trying to change halacha. They just wanted to make things better, okay, within halacha, which is, okay. And now the only thing is you have to see how careful you have to be, because people came later, the reformers that came later, and said, well, a lot of those changes that they made were great. We're going to incorporate them. And they're going to, a lot of these things are going to be, we're going to see in Germany, and things are going to change also. The reform is going to use these revolutionary times and everything for them as well. This is Louis Napoleon, and now the king, I guess really like next week, so this is, Louis Napoleon was here in the Batavian or in Holland or this area. Now this is the orange over here is going to be, I'm sorry, take it back. I think it's the red. This red.
There's a key up in the upper
I know,
right.
I see it, but it's not fitting. But the Jerome Napoleon, another brother, is going to be the king of Westphalia. Westphalia, they're going to carve an area out of Germany. He's going to end the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire. He's going to remove the emperor. He's going to change all. This is when it all ends. And he's going to make his brother. He calls an area called Westphalia, and his brother Jerome is going to be king. When he is king, he's going to come into contact with a person by the name of Isaac Jacobson. This is the, you know, the previews for the next class. And Isaac Jacobson, he is the official father of reform, and he is going to use this, the government, and Jerome to really push forth his agenda, his changes of reform. Just, you'd think that things were better on the one hand for the Jews when Louis became back, because when Louis became the king, so the Batavian Republic stopped, and like I said, the consistory voted this shul out of existence. But on the other hand, Louis was also into, he had his ideas of what the Jews should be. So a number of things, he changes, there was no more, everything was a consistory. It wasn't like you had the old way of Parnassim, which if you had seven good Parnassim, from Parnassim you keep the community from. But now it's under the government, it's consistories. He forced the Parnassim, okay. The chief rabbi had to be Dutch born, or resident of Holland for 6 years. They wanted to use the Dutch Bible instead of the Hebrew one. Instruction had to be in Dutch. You can't get married outside the shul. King Louis suppressed the Yiddish language. Okay, so this king, he wasn't king more than 4 years, and after 4 years he was out, and they went back to the House of Orange. But like everything else, the cat's out of the bag. You know, it's things are now changed for the foremost. The consistory was out, the Parnassim came back in, but lots of things that were put into place are going to be there for the future. So what we just what you see here, what the main thing here is that this shul, which was able to exist and made these changes, the reform are going to take many of these changes, just about all of these changes, and say, hey, we are now, that's going to be our new shul of the future. And they're going to use this shul, even though this shul stayed within the confines of halacha,
right.
At least they wanted to. Also, very important, this shul did not touch the davening at all. They didn't change anything about the davening. The main davening, Pesukei Dezimra, Berachos Kriyas Shema, Shema, the Shemoneh Esrei, they didn't say we're changing words, we're taking things out. The extra piyutim and yotzos and all that they did take out, but they didn't touch the davening itself, which is, we'll see what's going to happen next time. All right, thank you all. And
thank you.